ability to fight terrorism. Can you believe they are applying anti-terror laws to journalists? And they admit it. You know, the most serious thing is that Scotland Yard didn't deny they are journalists. They acknowledge they are journalists. So they have a plan here. And the plan is to criminalize any kind of serious, aggressive, and fearless journalism, exposing state criminality at the highest level. And they want to punish it as they publish spies. I think it's extremely important journalism, and it has been copied by many, and none of them are in prison, none of them are being put in prison, or so it's, you know, it's crucial. We have to win this case, Richard. We have absolutely to win this case.
In the background, while these developments in Assange's case have been taking place, the British government has continued to clamp down on press freedoms through various means. In a document titled Legislation to Counter State Threats, which was published in May 2021, the Home Office proposed a series of reforms to the Official Secrets Act. Now, these proposed reforms seek harsher sentencing for whistleblowers and journalists who publish classified documents. Under Priti Patel's Home Office proposal, the government argues that unauthorized disclosures are just as bad, if not worse, than espionage. It says, quote, "We do not consider that there is necessarily a distinction in severity between espionage and the most serious unauthorized disclosures," unquote. So the British government is essentially saying that since journalists and publishers can reach a wider audience and reach more people, an unauthorized disclosure on their part is worse than an enemy spy stealing documents, because that would only benefit one state actor and cause less damage somehow. This is simply unbelievable. Not only that, but the British government has still failed to include an adequate public interest defense and wishes to increase the maximum sentence of 2 years for journalists and whistleblowers who publish things the government doesn't like. This document is effectively and explicitly criminalizing investigative journalism and equating it with espionage. The recent revelation in the Assange case that a key witness lied in their testimony is hardly surprising at all, because the entire legal case is filled with illegalities and wrongdoing on the behalf of various governments, and one of those governments is the British government. According to former employees of UC Global, they admit that the firm was contracted by US intelligence to spy on Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. This included listening in on Assange's conversations with his lawyers, which violates his right to a fair trial and right to due process under virtually every jurisdiction, whether EU or US or British common law. There was even a plan to kidnap and poison him, which was discussed. I mean, the fact that the judge accepted all the political charges against Assange, which are not only untrue, but also criminalizes journalism, is extremely disheartening. At the end of the day, she did block his extradition, but she also blocked his bail request. It took six months, since the ruling, just to get permission for the US to appeal, meaning that Assange could spend years in jail just getting through this dragged out legal process, right? Languishing in Belmarsh prison, in a maximum security prison, his mental and physical health indicate. And in her ruling, Judge Bretzer, she went on through each charge under US law and equated it to British common law under the Official Secrets Act in order to satisfy the criteria for an extradition. And this expansion of the legal case into British law is worrying enough on its own. However, the new prospects and proposals by the British government go even further, and they explicitly criminalize standard journalistic activities and whistleblowers for exposing government crimes and government wrongdoing. If the big media outlets in the UK were honest, they would be outraged about what's happening to Assange or these proposed reforms to the Official Secrets Act. Instead, what do? They quietly stay away from these issues and barely report on them in order to protect the government from criticism and scrutiny, because they are dishonest actors and they work on behalf of the British state. We saw in previous months how the United Kingdom under Boris Johnson's government, with no opposition from Keir Starmer's Labour, passed several authoritarian laws. This included the Covert Human Intelligence Sources, or CHIS Act, allowing undercover agents in the UK to commit criminal acts in the name of Britain's national and economic security. We also saw the passage of the Overseas Operations Bill, giving British troops immunity from war crimes prosecutions in violation of international law. The British government then introduced the Police Court Sentencing and Crimes Bill, giving police sweeping powers to shut down protests. In addition, to sentencing of up to 10 years for people who deface a statue. This suggestion by the government to equate journalists now with spies and punish them under the Official Secrets Act for doing their jobs by informing the public, this is merely an extension of these same draconian, archaic laws. It's yet another step away from democracy and towards authoritarianism. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The term post-traumatic stress disorder is widely used to describe the psychological effects of war or disaster. Yet the term may not be applicable to Palestinians who have been attacked repeatedly and oppressed without pause for many decades. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Esra Saleh Al-Nami, reporter. This article is published under the heading, Trauma is Constant for Gaza's Children. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Ahmad is aged at that age children can feel increasingly confident. Their creativity can blossom. They can become more aware of what is happening in the world. Over the past 8 years, Ahmad has been exposed to a world of both horror and joy. He has already lived through two large-scale Zionist regime attacks on Gaza, one in summer of 2014, the other in May this year. On May 15th, the Zionist regime bombed the Abu Khattab family's home in Bish refugee camp without warning. Of the 10 people martyred in that incident, 2 were mothers and 8 were children. Ahmad was a neighbor and friend to some of those children. He cannot understand why they were wiped out so violently. "We used to play together in the yard," he said. "We played football and hide and seek. Why will we never see them again?" Both during and after the May attack, Ahmad has encountered trouble sleeping at night. When he gets to sleep, he often has nightmares. The term post-traumatic stress disorder is widely used to describe the psychological effects of war or disaster. Yet the term may not be applicable to Palestinians who have been attacked repeatedly and oppressed without pause for many decades. Dr. Yasser Abu Jam'i from the Gaza Community Mental Health Program points out that each Israeli regime attack triggers painful memories of previous attacks. Healing thereby becomes more difficult. Gazans are not in a post-traumatic condition, but in an ongoing condition that needs deeper attention, he wrote during the May offensive. In 2020, the Gaza Community Mental Health Program assisted more than 3,200 children, according to Abu Jam'i. It is 2 months since the Israeli regime's latest attack ended, he told the electronic Intifada. We don't yet have the final figures for how many children we are assisting because of that attack, but I can tell you that the numbers are big, and they will be bigger than those for the last year. There has been a discernible increase, Abu Jam'i confirmed, in problems associated with childhood stress since the May offensive. Such problems include hyperactivity, disobedience toward parents, nightmares, aches in joints, and panic attacks. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor states that before the May attack, approximately 33% of Gaza's children required support because of trauma resulting from previous Israeli regime violence. The proportion of children who are traumatized has risen to more than 90% following the May offensive. The Zionist regime killed 66 children during the attack. 11 of those children had been receiving psychological support from refugee councils. Muhammad 11 vomited frequently in the 2 weeks after the May attack. His weight dropped considerably. "The area near us was bombed very heavily," said Muhammad's father. "My son was terrified. He started to deteriorate gradually. As a result of trauma care, Muhammad's health has subsequently improved." Dr. Sami Oveda from the Gaza Community Mental Health Program has counseled Muhammad. "Encouraging children to express themselves is vital," Oveda noted. "We notice sometimes that children avoid speaking about the traumatic experiences that they went through," he said. "Our task is to urge them to speak about their experiences and to share their fears. We have to respect children's thoughts and feelings so that we can disperse their fears. Reaching out to their mothers or fathers for comfort is literally impossible for some." More than 240 children lost one or both parents during the May attack, according to Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Turning to teachers is not a viable option in many cases either. Schools in Gaza remain closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The situation makes dealing with trauma all the more difficult. "Children need to spend time together," said Oveda. "In school, they are with their peers. They can talk and express themselves better for that reason. The importance of having a good time cannot be exaggerated for traumatized children. Much therapy is based on enabling children to have fun." Oveda said children need to play. That is how they release the negative energy inside them.
the World with reporters.
There is no evidence of institutional racism in the UK, says a report commissioned by the British government, but a landmark art exhibition on the doorsteps of Queen Elizabeth II paints a very different picture.
War in the Babylon is the title of this exhibition about black communities and their long struggle against systemic racism here in the UK. It comes 10 years after the police killing of unarmed black man Mark Duggan on the streets of London, with the aim of shining a light on his family's struggle for justice, as well as many more families who have lost a loved one at the hands of the British state.
Since 1990, there have been 1,433 people who have died in police custody. While the majority of deaths are white British, there is a disproportionate overrepresentation of black people who die as a result of use of force or restraint by the police.
10 years since the killing of Mark Duggan, but in 2015, in Haringey, the same borough, they killed Jermaine Baker. Last week, we had a notice put out that another person of colour, black person, has been killed in Haringey by the same police.
Stafford Scott, the curator of the exhibition, and who supported many of these families in their fight for justice, designed the showcase to illustrate how systemic racism is not just present in the police force, but something that permeates through different institutions in British society.
The War in the Babylon is an exhibition that we hope encapsulates the entirety of the black experience in the UK. You'd have recently heard this foolishness from some report by some geezer called Tony Sewell that said that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country. War in the Babylon says that that's an absolute lie and provides the absolute evidence that that is a lie.
The pictures, videos and texts present an account for those whose voices are often not heard, or worse still, willfully ignored by the mainstream.
We're at the Mall. That's the same address as the Queen of England, the Queen of England resides. We've moved the front line in the fight against racism and the fight for truth and rights from off of the estates, from out of the hood, and we've taken it right to the heart of the establishment.
The need for exhibitions like this is as pertinent now as it's ever been, especially as the British government expands policies like racially disproportionate blanket stop and search, while simultaneously denying the existence of institutional racism, signalling to black communities in the UK that their historic fight for equality is far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killing.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
هناك هدفان من الاستهداف.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity, and second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian minors were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition.
Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warn that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hamoud Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism, which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zeynep of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but they cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zeynep were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machineries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly, the events of December 12, 2015, is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement, and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters, have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Three 3,000 of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan. But conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting a new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in state affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors
the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also traveling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, yeah, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than a half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, oh, again and again and again. We have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people and the rule of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop and search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protests that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. When the Holy Prophet himself, greetings be upon him and his household, was surrounded by the representatives of the people of Yathrib in order to invite him to that city, which was later on renamed as Madinat al-Nabi, city of the Prophet, and when they spoke to him in Mina, he asked them to make the same pledge, saying to them that he would come to the city provided that they defend and support him at the cost of their lives. And they agreed and promised to do so. Later on, when he entered Medina, he established an Islamic government and imposed the authority of Islam. This authority originated from the fact that he was a prophet, not from anything else. Because he was a prophet and people believed in him, he established a government. After his demise too, despite the differences over his successor, as you know, there were disagreements over who would succeed him. No one from among Muslims, including those who had disagreements about the successor, doubted that every government that was supposed to be formed should pivot around religion and the Quran. Therefore, the issue of the authority of religion and of Islam is a really clear issue, and it is a requirement for belief in Islam. In other words, if someone believes in Islam, having carefully thought about the ideological principles of Islam, they should come to believe in the governance of Islam in society as well. The role of the people in establishing an Islamic government and in determining their own fate. As for the Republican and Democratic side of the issue and the strength of the people's votes, this is a very important issue as well. This matter should be examined from two perspectives. One is the religious and ideological perspective related to people's responsibility and rights, and another perspective is the implementation of the governance of religion, which is not possible without the people. The first perspective is related to people's responsibilities. The people's presence is decisive in establishing the Islamic government. In the Holy Quran and in Islamic narrations, there are many clear points about people's duty towards the fate of their society.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away, here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015,
Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back, so we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more element."
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont, there's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite.
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe that DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day, right there. They took our pictures.
It's you?
That's me, without gray hair.
In the middle?
Yep. You know, I was so happy.
You're smiling.
I was. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, sir?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose, the eye as a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years, where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
Time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around her face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon. All of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men. Just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for year and year, you know. And we didn't realize that our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. They had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with 3 other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement. None of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982,
34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than do anything, they just wrote it out. I never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lives if they would have told us there's a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We track down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstruction history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look at it and say, oh, okay, bang. You put it over, and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy. And I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. About it was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me, I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So, 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. they've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about